Alexander. One second as we wait for everything to catch up here on YouTube and the stream. Let's see, the stream looks good. All right, everything is looking good. Looking good, good connection. I think we have good audio. 18 likes. Let's get those likes up, everybody. How's everyone doing this Saturday evening? Right now in Greece, Alexander, everything closes at 12 o'clock. And it's really funny because, you know, Greece, people would go out at 12 o'clock. They would like go out for dinner at 12 o'clock on a Saturday night, and everything is open till, you know, 7, 8 in the morning or whenever the restaurants, bars, or clubs close. Now it closes at 12 o'clock, and everyone from like 9 to 12 descends onto the squares or the restaurants. I mean, everyone, from teenagers to grandparents to everyone.
Yeah, so it is in effect spreading the thing further, because of course the whole point is you want to space them out so that people don't in fact come congregate in groups. But there you go,
and that's, everyone is like in the same place, because you know they've got this 3-hour window to go out, eat dinner, get a drink, talk with friends, hang out with family, whatever they need to do. It's crazy.
Can I just say, by the way, to our viewers that one of the great, really pleasant things about living in Greece, especially Athens, I find, is precisely that you can go out there at any hour of the day and night, and there is something going on. I mean, you can go out and have a really good meal at a really nice restaurant, 3 o'clock in the morning. It's not difficult.
That is true. That is true. Yeah. And so I got an email from a viewer, Alexander, before we get started. We're waiting for more people to come in. And how you doing, Iron Horse? Good to see you here. Hello, Nigel, Katie, Jim, David. And one of the viewers wanted to know if you would be able to do a video, Alexander, or if we could do a video on what's going on in the UK with the lockdowns and Boris's Parliament speech.
I think that's a very good idea, and I think we should do. I mean, I think we should definitely do that, because this is obviously becoming a massive story.
And, how has poll numbers? I mean,
this is the extraordinary thing, and it really surprises me for the moment. And now, of course, we haven't seen very recent polls, but you know, right up to the run up of this, he's still steadily polling over 40% or more. And I put that entirely down to the continued effect of Brexit and the fact that the opposition, Labour Party, is not being very effective at all, for many reasons, on many issues. When it comes to this particular crisis, I mean, as far as I can see, their policy is the mirror of the government's. They don't criticise the government on it. So you have this very strange political atmosphere here in Britain, where on the one hand, the country is obviously facing many problems, and there's a widespread perception that the government is not doing things well. And at the same time, there isn't any real belief that the alternative is going to be any better, and the fairly widespread view that it might be worse. It's a bit like the United States, but it's different from the United States. And I'll tell you where the difference is. There is none of that great enthusiasm that you find amongst Trump supporters in Britain. I mean, you won't find enthusiasm. There's no Johnson supporters who are enthusiastic in the way that Trump supporters can be enthusiastic about Trump. So that's one difference. And I think it would be impossible for the Labour Party to come across as quite as sinister an organisation as the DNC does in the United States. And that's obviously going to be the main topic of our discussion this evening. So we will say more about that later.
All right. So we'll do a video on that. Hello, Jim from California, Saskatchewan, Canada. Yeah. Hello. Hey, guys, made a little vid on Wormwood. That's kind of scaring the crap out of everyone. Hope you can find time to watch. Send me that vid. Send me that vid and we'll check it out. Hello, Susanna. How are you? Philip, how you doing? Midnight Joker. I don't think they will smear her.
Don't be so sure.
It was a little bit. I mean, what do they always say? You shouldn't. You should never try to be sarcastic in writing, in text. What's that? What's that expression, Alexander, that they say? Don't try to express sarcasm in text.
Yeah,
or,
I know you. You know,
in print. It wasn't sarcastic. It was just kind of, you know.
Yeah.
Will they smear her? I mean, okay, we know they're going to smear her, but I think the we're talking about. Well, right now, I think it's pretty much a done deal that Amy Coney Barrett. Hello, Helen. How are you? Amy Coney Barrett is going to be the next Supreme Court. She's going to be the Supreme Court nominee. And then, yes, of course, the Senate is going to have to confirm her, which I'm also certain they will do. Mm. They have the have the green light to move forward and confirm her.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the main question, Alexander, is how aggressively will they smear her? Because unlike Kavanaugh, you know, a white guy, you know, your typical like American white guy, Amy Coney Barrett is a little bit different in that, okay, she's a female, but we knew she was going to be a female, but she's a mother of seven, two adopted kids from Haiti, Catholic. There's 65 million Catholics in the United States. Mm-hmm. She's very religious, but I don't think they're overblowing the religious aspect because that's probably the line of attack that they want to take with her.
Mm.
But I think it definitely has a lot of pitfalls if they go very hard on her in the same manner that they went on towards Kavanaugh, which towards Kavanaugh, let's just say it. I mean, they fabricated the entire thing. I mean, the whole thing from top to bottom was completely fabricated in the most sinister and disgusting way.
Yeah.
Let me read you four tweets, Alexander, which are kind of interesting. Three tweets. Mm. I've got Twitter open to see if there's any announcements going on, but I think Trump's going to announce it at 5 o'clock Eastern time, US. So the first tweet is from Leonidas Johnson. People are now attacking Amy Coney Barrett for having too many kids. So let me get this straight. The unhinged radical left believes that ACB should have the choice over her body in regards to killing her children, but not to actually having them. And that's in reference, of course, the big thing that everyone's going to be talking about is Roe v. Wade. And that's where I think they're going to really try to attack her. From another tweet from Morgan Gaines, Joe Biden can be Catholic, but Amy Coney Barrett can't. Liberals apparently thrive on double standards. And from Charlie Kirk, he says, apparently attacking Hunter Biden for his involvement in a Russian human trafficking ring is off limits, but attacking Amy Coney Barrett's adoption, Haitian kids, isn't. So that's from Charlie Kirk. Kind of gives a little bit of insight as to how they're going to attack her. I think the question is, how aggressive are they going to be? Do they really want to go down that rabbit hole and really attack her the way they did Kavanaugh? That could really hurt them come November.
I agree with that. I'm going to say something. I think the trouble the Democrats have is controlling their temper. I mean, sometimes it makes no sense to go after somebody in a completely aggressive way. But I think they may struggle not to on this occasion. Firstly, because they're incredibly angry that the situation has arisen at all, especially just before the election. I mean, the timing is very, very bad for them. That's one thing. The second is, precisely because she is not vulnerable to the kind of attacks that they exposed Kavanaugh to. I mean, because she's a woman, because she's a family person. Well, of course, he's a family person too, but it's somehow different with a woman. And of course, she's ticked so many of the boxes. I mean, she's got adopted children, one of them from Haiti. So, I mean, you know, things that make it very difficult to find the kind of weapons to use against her that they used against Kavanaugh. And that, of course, makes them angrier still because, of course, they want to attack her, but they don't quite know how they're going to do it. But, you know, she's also, by the way, and this is the other thing, by the way, this is also true of Kavanaugh, it was also true of Gorsuch. She's a very, very, very good jurist. But compared with the other, perhaps, well, Gorsuch is an exceptional jurist, but she is an exceptional jurist as well, by all accounts. And if you read some of her cases, which I've done, but very cursorily, you could see a very, very strong and powerful legal mind. in action there. So they just don't have a handle, really.
Can you explain that, comparing it to Ruth Bader Ginsburg? Because you said in a previous video that we did that, and I think you were spot on, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and I'll summarize, I'll try to simplify what you said. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a good lawyer activist, like a legal activist is, and correct me if I'm wrong, and you can expand on it. She was a good legal activist, but a terrible jurist.
Yes.
Amy Coney Barrett, ACB, it's called ACB, is, from what I'm understanding, what you're saying is an exceptional jurist.
Yes.
And that's what we need in the Supreme Court. Can you expand on, on what I just said?
I mean, this is the fundamental difference. I mean, Ginsburg, who was, by the way, you know, an intellectual heavyweight. I'm not trying to make her out to be any kind of lightweight. But her entire career was, her main career was as a practicing lawyer, fighting cases in court, taking them to the court, arguing them there, arguing them with passion, with conviction, sometimes with great anger. But, you know, anger is something that lawyers do. And she was somebody who had very, very strong convictions and sought to change and bend and push the law in the direction that she wanted in accordance with those convictions. And, you know, that's, you know, lawyers like that are you know, they have a role. I mean, there's no question about it. The legal system needs lawyers like that to come and push what the law is. But when you become a Supreme Court justice, or indeed, even in my opinion, a justice, a judge in a superior court, your job is no longer to shape the law in that way. You're no longer there to win cases or fight causes. Your job is to expound and administer the law. You need to do that impartially. You need to put your convictions and your passions and your anger entirely to one side, because that's what a judge is. A judge has to be impartial, and a judge also has to have that extraordinary feeling and understanding of the law that is separate from having, you know, a tremendous feeling of for your case. Lawyer looks around, a practitioner looks around for case authorities they can mobilize, like sort of soldiers in a battle, in order to win. Whereas a judge doesn't do that. A judge has to look at the entirety of the law and have a feel for the law and understand how the law should be expressed in any particular given situation. It's a completely different thing. And if you look at the careers of these two people, Ginsburg and ACB, I'll call her ACB. ACB has only been a legal practitioner for about 2 years over the course of her career. Most of the rest of the time, she has been either an academic or a judge, an appeal court judge. So that's, in my opinion, a much more appropriate training for a Supreme Court justice. I'm going to add something. I said that, you know, a good judge is one who has a feel for the law. A good Supreme Court justice, especially, is one who has a feel for the law and expounds the law. A truly great Supreme Court judge is on another level. It's a judge through whom the law speaks. So it's actually, they become, if you like, the voice of the law. The law speaks through them. And there have been like judges like that. I mean, you know, you can go through US history, you know, all the way to people like, you know, I could throw around a few names, you know, Hugo Black and the great Antonin Scalia. You have, those are the sort of judges that ultimately make you, people sit back and they remember their judgments, and you read their judgments decades, sometimes centuries afterwards, and you say to say, well, that isn't just the judge's opinion about the law. That is the law itself. It's all set out there. It's clear. It's strong. It makes sense. And again, Ginsburg had no understanding of that. That wasn't what she was into at all. I think with ACB, it's possible she may turn out to be, especially if she becomes a Supreme Court justice now, and she'll be on the Supreme Court for a long time, and she'll become even closer to the law by being there through that long time that she will be there. So, you know, it's something, she's certainly someone to watch anyway. And if she does become a Supreme Court justice, as I firmly expect, and I'm sure she'll be nominated, and I'm sure the Senate would confirm her, why wouldn't it? Then I think she's certainly a Supreme Court justice to watch. I mean, she could be a outstanding justice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are some people saying that it could have been, and it may be, Barbara Lagoa. I mean, there's some rumors, but for the most part, I think everyone is reporting, including Republicans, that it will be Amy Coney Barrett. And I think that, you know, it would be kind of a cruel trick if there was an audible and it was a different person than Amy Coney Barrett, given that there's just so much hype around it. But I mean, you never know. So, I mean, we'll keep a little bit of caution there, that maybe it's not going to be Amy Coney Barrett. But for this live stream, let's focus on who is, I would say, 90% guaranteed to be that nominee. Alexander, I read a couple of articles where they are actually hitting Amy Coney Barrett on the fact that she only has 2-3 years of legal practice. And they're saying that she's completely inexperienced to be a Supreme Court judge because of that. And you're arguing the exact opposite.
Exactly. And I didn't know that they'd been attacking her on that basis. And you've just heard what I've just said. I think on the contrary, as I said previously, I think for a Supreme Court justice, this is the best training. Now, in a judge in a local court in the United States who has to hear cases, at a much lower level, is perhaps some more legal training, some more legal experience as a practitioner might be helpful. But when you are sitting on the Supreme Court, it's the law you have to understand. And everything that I know of her suggests that she does. People don't understand this, I think. Some of the people who are saying this perhaps don't understand it. Some of them, of course, are just using it in order as a stick to criticize her. But anybody who has worked in the superior courts, as I have in England, I mean, I've seen the High Court, I've seen the Court of Appeal, I've seen even the Supreme Court in Britain, the House of Lords as it used to be, the Appellate Committee of the House of Lords as it then was. You know, I've seen that in action. And as I say, it's the legal philosophers who you really need there. And they don't really come through so much, you know, on the battlefield where advocates are basically scoring points and fighting battles with each other and are using the law as an instrument. The judge doesn't use the law as an instrument. The judge is the instrument of the law. It's a different perspective entirely, especially at the level of these superior courts and the ultimate superior court, not just in the United States, but the world, is the Supreme Court of the United States.
All right. So technically, the nominee could be approved, voted in by the Senate, literally in 15 minutes if they wanted to. Yeah. I mean, technically speaking, they could do it. Mm. But Lindsey Graham has said that he will create some sort of process, some sort of hearings or nomination process where they question whoever it is. Mm. What kind of process do you think they're going to come up with?
Well, I hope a much less...
Even Kavanaugh, given what we saw with Kavanaugh.
Well, exactly. I mean, I hope nothing like that, because that was a disaster. I mean, they got embarrassed with what happened, I think, to some of the other ones, which, like Clarence Thomas. So they massively overcompensated and they opened it up to, massive attack and abuse by the Democrats. So I think what will happen is we will have a meeting at the level of the Judiciary Committee, which Lindsey Graham chairs. By the way, this should help Lindsey Graham if he runs it well in his own rather difficult fight for re-election, because he's standing for re-election and apparently it's quite tight where he is. But hopefully this will be time limited to a couple of days, and questions will be limited, and they won't, and a strong chair will ensure, Lindsay will ensure as a strong chair, that, you know, frivolous and stupid questions aren't asked and don't take up time. And then it will go straight to the Senate floor and we should have a vote. I mean, I don't see why this whole process can't take a week. That's my own personal view. I mean, I think 15 minutes, obviously, you're not going to do something as important as this in 15 minutes or an hour or a day. But I mean, I'd say a week, two at most. I don't see why it needs to be longer.
So, I mean, they're not going to open her up to the Democrat senators, you know, really going into long questionings of her. Once again, like what we saw in Kavanaugh, a long process in the Senate, which would then mean that you're going to have the mainstream media act as surrogates in smearing the pick. I mean, they're going to have to pick up the slack. So the Rachel Maddows, the Cuomos, Lemons, all these guys, they're going to pick up the slack and they're going to start going on the attack, because I don't think Graham, Trump, the Republicans, Mitch McConnell are going to want to give the Democrats too much time or too much leeway in any type of, you know, back and forth questioning. To let it drag on and you know, to start bringing, you know, because they're going to try to bring up more controversies and they're going to try to, you know, bring up scandals. I would imagine they want to do it quick. So you're looking at the media going after her in essence.
Well, yes. Can I just say a few things about this? Firstly, if you follow the impeachment, Adam Schiff barely allowed the Republicans to ask any questions at all. I mean, he completely froze them out. So, you know, why not? I'm not saying you should do it to the same extent, not on a judicial thing, but it seems to me that Democrats want to complain about the fact that they're not being allowed to ask all the questions that they wanted to ask. Just remind them of what Adam Schiff did with the support of the Democrats and of the media during the impeachment proceedings. But what happened during the Kavanaugh case, and I thought it was deplorable, was that this whole thing became so incredibly prolonged and spun out that the Democrats and the media were able to come up all the time with new allegations whenever it seemed that Kavanaugh was getting on top of, you know, the original allegations. So we were having constantly shifting goalposts because, you know, he'd come along, he'd very effectively refute one thing, and then they'd come up with another because they were being given the time to do that and the oxygen to do that. And then we'd have all these extraordinary, I don't know if you remember, we'd have all these, you know, letters and messages and new witnesses who were constantly coming forward. And it was a train wreck of a confirmation hearing. And we had all kinds of people coming into the Senate building and, you know, shouting and all that. So, I mean, it was awful. And it was because Grassley, who was in charge of it, Senator Grassley, lost control of it. He was overcompensating. He was allowing too many questions to be put, and the whole thing turned into a circus. What you need is to move this thing forward. You should be doing that anyway, by the way, regardless of whether there's an election coming or not. It's not fair to the candidate to actually put them through all that. And can I just say something? Because this is one of the great misrepresentations of that was made during the Kavanaugh process. This is not a job interview. No way is this any kind of job interview. As they were saying during the, you know, the Democrats were saying, well, it's a job interview, so we can ask this person any questions. And no principles of due process or propriety apply. It's not a job interview. It is a Senate confirmation hearing. She has had her job interview, which is with Donald Trump, who's nominating her. The Senate is there to confirm her. It's not there to, you know, redo all that all over again. It's a complete misunderstanding of this process. And what job interview is ever conducted in public, you know, with all the world watching? I mean, that's an absurd idea. I was stunned that people were coming up with that, a complete misunderstanding of the whole process over Kavanaugh. So do this quickly, do this tightly. Lindsey Graham, who after all got very angry, I remember, during the Kavanaugh affair, and you remember he actually exploded at one point, very rightly in my opinion. Please keep control of this one and get it done. I mean, that's your job.
Yeah. You know what the difference is? Is that you do have an election, but not the presidential election. You know, you nailed it when you said Lindsey Graham. You have many senators who are up for re-election. And I think you told me earlier that Lindsey Graham is up for a tough re-election
apparently
in South Carolina. And you have a lot of senators who are going to need the endorsement and the support of Donald Trump, because Trump is the Republican Party, whether they like it or not. When Kavanaugh was being confirmed, my suspicion is, this is just a suspicion, that you had a lot of Republicans in name only, who still could not accept that Trump was not only the U.S. president, but also the leader of the Republican Party.
Yes.
The de facto leader of the Republican Party. And I think they still had it in for him. And I think Kavanaugh kind of also paid a price there, in that people like Grassley could have put a stop to it. But I think Grassley said, oh, just let's embarrass Trump just a little bit here. Let's just stick it to Trump just a little bit. And I think someone like Lindsey Graham, who's probably a little more shrewd than the Grassleys, I think Graham started to realize, you know what, maybe we shouldn't, really crucify this guy Kavanaugh too much, because, you know, my popularity, he's probably thinking my popularity is going to take a huge hit. And we saw a lot of Democrats who did lose election. I think four Democrats actually did lose their seat, mostly because of what they did to Kavanaugh. Mm. So I think Lindsey Graham was a little bit shrewd and clever in that he had that outburst and that won him points. Mm. But I think back then, the Republicans wanted to stick it to Trump as well. Yeah. Kavanaugh paid a dear price for it. This time around, I think they're going to say, you know what? Mm. Let's not screw with Trump this time around. Russiagate's been debunked and destroyed. Ukrainegate debunked and destroyed. You know, Trump has laid waste to all these people that have gone after him, to everyone that's gone after him. He's utterly laid waste to them. And I think that these guys want him in their corner when they go up for re-election.
I think that's entirely right. I mean, one of the key points, of course, is that when Kavanaugh came up, I mean, Russiagate was still going. I mean, Mueller was still doing whatever it was he was doing. I mean, not even clear to me any longer what actually he was investigating at that point. But he was supposedly still investigating. And the Republicans were letting him do so. I mean, the Senate Republicans had all the information that we've been doing recent videos about and talking about. The Republicans knew about it. I mean, they basically knew the whole story by then. And they were not coming out and talking about it. So Trump was in a much weaker position at that time, because he still had the shadow of Russiagate hanging over him. And of course, now that's been dispelled, however much the Democrats want to put life into that specter. It's basically been, dissipated away. And then, of course, then he got Kavanaugh confirmed, which is an important win for him, I think. And then there was the disastrous Ukrainegate impeachment. So I think from this point on, Republicans, the dynamic amongst the Republicans of the Senate has changed completely. And I think, as you rightly say, I mean, they now understand that they have to solidify around Trump. I would add, I do hope Collins and Murkowski are sensible about this one. I mean, if it is ACB, and all the indications are that it will be, then, you know, are they really going to vote against someone who is an outstanding jurist, a woman, nothing bad or wrong or inappropriate about her past? Are they really going to vote against her, a Republican choice selected by Republican precedent, because they have some bizarre idea that they should be put off until after the election? I mean, that's a crazy thing. I mean, you know, they've been, I really think if they do that, then Collins, who's apparently facing a difficult fight in Maine, is toast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Trump the other day said that the result of the election may go to the Supreme Court. And he actually said, that's why I am going to fill that seat, because this thing may end up in the Supreme Court. We've done many programs, including a live stream on the Red Mirage plan. on the mail-in ballots. And I think it's now pretty common knowledge. I mean, the Democrats have just pretty much laid it all out on the table, how they plan to go about these elections. You know, we've had, I believe that North Carolina is the latest state. We have Michigan, you have Pennsylvania, and now you have North Carolina, which have recently put legislation forth that allows mail-in ballots to run 1 to 2 weeks after the elections that they can be counted. So these are obviously important battleground states. And just an FYI, the lawyer that actually got that through North Carolina is Mark Elias. I don't know if that name, you know, from Russiagate, Perkins Coie fame. That same Mark Elias, I think was named, that same guy who was working with what's his name? Glenn Simpson.
That's right.
So he's the one that actually got this through in North Carolina. So he is, you know, that guy may be sinister, but he's effective for the Democrats.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He's a, he's a very useful hatchet man for the Democrats. What the Italians call a consigliere, somebody who comes along, you know, a sort of mafia don, as a consigliere, a lawyer who will do all the hard work for him when it's needed. Yeah. And that's what Elias is for the Democrats.
So when this goes to the Supreme Court, Alexander, I mean, how do you see it shaking out? Do you think that this does have a good chance to end up in the Supreme Court, the U.S. elections? I mean, the lawyers are going to be fighting like hell, I imagine. I mean, I imagine it's just going to be a complete, utter mess of legal battles. But eventually it could be to the Supreme Court. And many people are iffy on Roberts. We've talked about Roberts as well. He'll lean. How will he lean? So what do you think the scenario is there?
I think it's having a ninth judge. I think it's highly likely it will end up in the Supreme Court, because bear in mind, you know, way back in, was it 2000, when there was Bush versus Gore and there was issues in Florida, it was one state. This looks like many. And the other thing is, this is an innovation. These mail-in ballots are an innovation, really. Now, Representative Jordan has done a really actually very interesting report about mail-in ballots, which, of course, the media is not reporting and has basically disappeared. But one of the key point he's making is that these mail-in ballots are not ballots that, you know, somebody who can't go to vote or is away or whatever, there is a system where they can contact the local authorities and arrange to be provided with a postal ballot, which they then vote or whatever. These are unsolicited votes, mail votes, which are being sent to everybody by the local government, irrespective of whether they've asked for them or not. There's going to be this deluge of these things pouring through people's letterboxes. Probably there already is actually a deluge of these things pouring through letterboxes. And some of them, of course, you can't even return until election day, because those are the rules. Now, what you're in effect doing is you are changing the whole voting system in these states right in the run-up to a general election, you know, an absolutely key election. Now, I would have thought this was a constitutional issue, a serious constitutional issue. And you're quite right, there's going to be massive administrative problems. There's this crazy idea that you can go on counting these things for 12 days or 3 weeks or whatever it is after election day. I would have thought this is bound to go to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court is going to have to look at this and is going to have to decide whether this whole process is ultimately constitutional. Now, consider how incendiary that's going to be. Because a lot of people will maybe in many cases, in good faith, will vote in this fashion. And, you know, if it turns out that this is wrong, then, I mean, there's going to be lots of problems. I can foresee problems all down the line. And then, I mean, there's the administrative problems. There's the practice of sending the votes out in this fashion. I mean, this has been done in the most stealthy and chaotic way. And it's clearly been done in a way that's intended to favour one party in the election. And notice that the Democrats don't want to talk about the mechanics of it. And they don't really want to explain what a tremendous innovation. This is, if only because of the massive scale in which it's being done. By the way, can I just quickly add also that lots of countries have had vote elections over the time of the pandemic. It's perfectly possible to arrange polling in safe ways, in polling booths, without having, changing the entire electoral system in this fashion. That's a completely bogus argument.
Of course it is. I mean, look.
Yeah. It's a completely bogus argument.
It's bogus, but they're working the mail-in ballot angle, the Democrats. That's how they're going to try to steal the election. They didn't bet on RBG passing away, and now they're going to get, most likely, Coney Barrett.
Yes.
And they've lost that Supreme Court 4-4. They were hoping maybe it would be a 4-4 split and they would be able to somehow put pressure, maybe through the military. They've mentioned that many times, maybe through the rioters to try and just, you know, grab that White House by exerting social pressure, even violence in the United States, and somehow get the Trump team to back down. Now you don't have that 4-4 split anymore. Now you have, if Roberts goes the other way, now you have a 5-4. I mean, it's essentially game over.
Well, this is exactly right. I mean, it would be game over. Well, of course, ACB, I was going to say APC, ACB is confirmed, then it's probably a 6-3 split, because I can't see Roberts doing anything other than going with the majority in that case. I mean, I really can't. So, I mean, I think that it would be absolute game over in that situation. And that's not what they expected. That's not what they want. That's why they're very, very angry. And they're very, very angry because it looks like Donald Trump is going to propose a candidate that they haven't got any real objection to, that she's conservative, that she's a Catholic. As you said, 65 million Catholics in America. It's not even supposed to be an issue because the Constitution, it says, you know, you shouldn't take into account people's religious affiliations, religious beliefs or affiliations. So, you know, even raising that issue is actually, you know, un-American to do.
Does it worry you that the Democrats may use ACB to energize their base because they'll make it an election referendum on Roe v. Wade, and they may be thinking that may be an issue that they could actually get people excited about, because no one's excited about Biden. Biden's disappeared. I mean, he hasn't shown his face in like 3-4 days. Harris hasn't shown her face in like 2 weeks. I mean, they're completely AWOL. They've completely just dropped out, and the mainstream media is doing the campaigning for them. It's really bizarre. But does it worry you that you know, Barrett Cohen has that weakness? Coney Barrett has that weakness that the Democrats may try to exploit, the Roe v. Wade?
No, I don't think I doesn't, actually. I think it's going to play out in exactly the opposite way. Because, you know, how do you hold a referendum on something like this? Ultimately, if ACB is confirmed, the battle is won for the Republicans and lost by the Democrats. You can't refight that battle in a referendum all over again. What he's far more likely to do is demoralize, this is my own opinion, demoralize the Democrat Party electorate, because they will say to themselves, well, we now have a 6-3 majority on the Supreme Court, electing Biden, who we're not particularly keen on anyway. What's he going to do? What's he good for? The only thing he was good for before was picking Supreme Court justices. If this is done, if this is already done, and it's a done deal, you know, what's the point of him? So I think it's more likely, instead of energizing them, to demoralize them. And as for, you know, Roe v. Wade and all that, I don't think that's going to work for exactly that reason. Actually, I'm going to say this. I mean, I you know, some people who are watching may disagree with me here, but I'm afraid I don't think Roe v. Wade is under any real threat. I mean, she's She's going to, I think, follow precedent. There's lots of precedent now. So, I mean, I don't think that ACB is going to overturn or work to overturn Roe v. Wade. I think there would have to be much bigger changes and shifts in opinion in the United States before that were to happen. I mean, it might happen one day, but it won't happen as quickly as people perhaps expect. But putting all that aside, the Democrats might think that will happen. They may say to themselves, Roe v. Wade is in danger. But given that it is a Supreme Court decision and that there is now a conservative majority on the Supreme Court, what can they do? They can't stop the Supreme Court changing its own precedent if that is what the Supreme Court decides. As I said, I'm not convinced it will decide it, but I don't see what a referendum, calling it a referendum, what difference it's going to make. So no, coming back to what I said, I think it will demoralize the Democrat base. I don't think it will energize them at all. I think they will say to themselves, Biden is useless. The Democrats are useless. The Supreme Court is lost. Why should I vote?
Yeah, I agree with you. I see your thinking there, and I think you're right. I mean, the minute you have the mail-in ballot plan has now just been completely destroyed because if I was the Democrats, if I was, you know, Pelosi and the Podestas and all these people game planning this out and saying, okay, we'll get this to the Supreme Court. We'll get we'll get a 4-4 split. We'll get the military to put pressure on Trump. We'll get the people out on the street and somehow we'll take the White House. That's gone. In other words, why even go through the mail-in ballot thing now anymore? Because at the end of the day, it's just going to head to the Supreme Court and it's going to get shot down. Mm-hmm. Biden is completely useless. Harris is completely useless. Mm-hmm. The whole thing's finito. It's over.
Well, I agree.
Now Biden has to campaign. Now he has to campaign.
I mean, I agree. I mean, I've always thought these schemes and plans and talk of, you know, are lunatic. And an admission, by the way. I mean, the Red Mirage is an admission that Trump will be the winner on election day. I mean, let's not forget that. You know, when the results come out on election day, they will show Trump winning the White House, except, of course, or staying in the White House, which is why, of course, Facebook, Twitter, all of those people want to suppress those results. But I mean, that's what's going to happen. And by the way, you see that admission all over the media now. Even it's even reaching the Guardian and the Financial Times and the Times here in London, that on election day, Trump will look the winner. Now, so it looks desperate. The whole thing is starting to look increasingly desperate. If they have a Supreme Court that is opposed to all of this, and you know they can't rely on to find in their favor, then, as you correctly say, this whole idea no longer has any point, any purpose. And I get to make another point, observation, by the way, which is that if they expect the military or the Secret Service or all of those people to move contrary to a decision of the Supreme Court, I just can't believe that. I simply don't imagine that's going to happen. So with this whole, all these schemes depend in the end on a compliant Supreme Court. If it's no longer there, then the whole thing fails.
Don't the lawyers, like the Democrat lawyers, aren't they telling the Democrat leadership this as well? I mean, the Mark Eliases, these guys, these top tier Democrat lawyers that are, you know, putting this whole plan together, and they're going to be in the states, the individual states, they're going to be contesting everything and trying to swing the electors towards Biden. I mean, don't they sit there now with Podesta and the Podesta brothers and Pelosi and Schumer and Schiff and all these guys and say, look, even if we sit there for 2 weeks, even if we sit in Pennsylvania for 2 weeks and we somehow get something done, at the end of the day, Nancy, it's just going to go to the Supreme Court and we're screwed. I mean, aren't the lawyers going to give some legal advice to the leadership?
I'm sure they are, and I'm sure they'll be saying we have an increasing problem. I mean, this isn't working out, and it's not the way it's going. I'm sure they're doing that. But, you know, come back to one of the points that we made at the start of this program when we compared ACB with Ginsburg. ACB, jurist, legal philosopher. Ginsburg, passionate legal practitioner and advocate. These people are advocates. They are the kind of people who do a job. They will be given a case. They will do a job. They will be convinced that, you know, they will believe in their job. So, you know, that will probably temper their ability to come back to that client and tell them the truth. And people like Elias, you know, when I compared him to a consigliere, you don't come to, you know, Michael Corleone and tell Michael Corleone, well, Michael, you know, your great strategy, your great legal strategy is going to fall apart. You don't do that. I mean, you know, you say, Michael, you are much more careful what you say. It might be safer or easier for you to go on pretending that there's a chance and, you know, go all the way to the Supreme Court and fail there, then come along and be the person who brings the bad news. So do be aware of those mechanics. By the way, I should say that, you know, I've met lawyers like that. I mean, you know, they do exist. When I talk about this, I mean, I know what I'm talking about. I have met people, and sometimes they're very effective and they're very clever and capable lawyers. But as I said, there are limitations, given the role that they're fulfilling.
All right, Alexander, we have debates on Tuesday, Trump and Biden, Tuesday in Cleveland, Ohio. Mm. What are the Democrats' options now? How do you see them going forward to try and steal this election? I mean, this was a big blow, RBG. That was a big blow for them. How do you see this playing out?
I think that they are increasingly left to playing the same tune. You know, Orange Man bad, Biden good, Orange Man incompetent, Biden, you know, the supremely competent person who's going to bring order back to the government of the United States, even though, as I said, as we said in a previous video and live, I think he is actually the candidate of chaos. We only have to go to U.S. cities to see that. I think one of the reasons, by the way, that Biden has disappeared is because, you know, they're training him, doing everything they basically can to try to make sure that he somehow gets through Cleveland.
They're putting together the cocktail of narcotics to get him up to speed.
So, you know, that he survives that. And so, I mean, they're going to be rehearsing him and they're going to be drilling every single point that they want him to make. Very difficult to do, but, you know, it can be done to some extent. So, you know, so this is what they need to do, I think, now. What they will do now, I think that they will try to keep this show on the road. And I don't think, by the way, that they've actually given up on the mail-in ballot thing. I don't think they have at all. I mean, we've been talking about the problems that it's running against, and those problems will grow. But I think that at some level they still viscerally determined to pull this thing off in that way. And it's very difficult for people who have got themselves together this very complicated and intricate plot, which they've talked about publicly. I mean, this is what's so bizarre about all of this. I mean, you know, all these stories about a red mirage, about using the military, about, you know, all mail-in ballots. It's all been discussed exhaustively in the media. So, I mean, you know, it's very difficult once you've committed yourself that far just to call this off. So I think they're just going to continue as they have been doing. In exactly the same way, and get face an even bigger defeat in November. That's my own personal view.
Yeah. Joe Rogan with the debate, guys. Well, Joe Rogan has problems at Spotify. They're giving him a hard time at Spotify. So it would be great if he did the debates, because I don't trust Chris Wallace, but I think Joe Rogan has got his hands full at Spotify right now. Well, I think after him. Yeah,
I think that's the other thing. I mean, they'll try and get the anchor to be as pro
Biden. Oh, he's got the questions. Biden already has the questions.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, so they'll be. This is what they're doing. They're rehearsing every answer. Yeah. Of course. The problem with doing that though is if it's too rehearsed, it begins to look unreal. And
like Marco Rubio.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. People can see through that. And it can actually, if it comes across as very stilted, and especially against a candidate like Trump, who's very exuberant and lively and vital, I mean, it can look very, it can be an actually very stark contrast. Whereas, strangely enough, if Biden, you know, gets through, answers questions, but, you know, does the old gaffe along the way, it might even, you know, in a genuine, help, you know, real way, you know, makes him look a bit human. He hasn't looked very human for me at all in this up to now. I mean, he's looked like, basically, dare I say it, the puppet he really is. I mean, you can almost see the strings.
Yeah, exactly. Do you think the Dems will send in a Biden clone? I don't know about clones, but, you know, there's always rumors that these, like, uber wealthy, like, politicians and billionaires, like, just... they get pumped up with so many drugs, or they have their blood like completely turned over every year so they could keep going. I mean, look, I'm sure they're looking at Biden from head to toe doctors, and they're trying to figure out, what do we do here? I'm sure they've got all the questions as well from Chris Wallace. I mean, you know, he's been gone for like 3-4 days. I'm sure there's a mass preparation now to figure out, how do we get Biden through this?
Yeah.
And I think it was no surprise that Pelosi came out for a second time and said Biden shouldn't do the debate, because I think Pelosi is kind of, you know, giving Biden a little bit of an off ramp in case the doctors and the analysts and the advisors and the people prepping him with questions go back to Nancy Pelosi and they say, Nancy, we've tried everything. And I mean, he's just not going to make it more than an hour. Nancy's not going to make it.
Well, that could very well be, and it wouldn't surprise me at all. I mean, that's entirely possible. And by the way, I mean, you know, if I wouldn't be surprised either if they come up with some kind of excuse between now and Cleveland and say, well, you know, it's maybe you know, so Trump, it's outrageous what he's doing, nominating a Supreme Court justice at this time. It dishonors, you know, the great, you know, Ginsburg and the protests. So we can't possibly sit down on the same table and have a debate with this evil man. I could very well see that happening. It wouldn't surprise me at all. By the way, what did you say about all of those cures and things? I mean, you know, I used to... Well, my family belonged to the kind of circles in Greece where people were involved in those, did receive those kind of treatments. And believe me, they exist. They really do exist. I mean, I can say that. And what I will say about them is they work, actually. Up to a certain point, they actually work. But inevitably and invariably, there is a price to pay. And that is that the deterioration afterwards becomes faster. So what you do is, in that kind of situation, you have to go on giving that treatment at ever more accelerated levels, you know, off more and more often, in more and more extreme ways, just to keep the person going. And of course, eventually the whole thing implodes and again and crashes, and you know, health crashes, and it can be actually very pitiful to see. And I have seen it. I've seen it happen exactly like that. I'm not naming any names, but there are people in Greece whom I could name, which well, I won't.
I mean, I've heard stuff like that about George Soros and these types of guys, that they do this every year. They get like this kind of, you know, overhaul, like you're taking a car to a garage, but they get massive overhaul.
That's
oil
right.
changed, everything, you know.
Well, that's right. Exactly right. I mean, that does happen. But, you know, first it's a year, then it's every 6 months, then it's every 3 months, then it's every month, then it's every 2 weeks, then it's every week, then it's every other day. And That's the kind of pattern you fall into.
All right. So we'll get to some super chats, but I want your thoughts, Alexander, connected to the debates. We've done two videos. We got more videos on the way. Mm. One with Hunter Biden and what's gone on there. Mm. Just explosive stuff. Mm. Even more explosive are the FBI texts and everything going on there. Mm. Sidney Powell, Flynn, and the information we have there. Do you think Trump's going to use it in the debates?
I hope he does, actually. I mean, this is where perhaps our viewers have a better feel for, you know, what the American people think than and feel about this than I do, because, of course, I'm talking from Britain, from perspective of Britain. But I think these are, as you correctly said, explosive. And I think I would ask him, I would ask Joe Biden, you know, what was your role? Are you really saying that you still consider people like Peter Strzok and Andrew McCabe and James Comey, God help us, to be, you know, patriots? And I would go for it. I would go for it hard. The only thing I would say about that is that the Russiagate, unfortunately, and indeed even Hunter Biden, unfortunately, have become such complicated stories that you need to have pretty highly developed forensic skills, I think, to cross-examine somebody in a really effective way about this. And Trump is not a forensic questioner. He has this tremendous ability to hit the spot with the American public on things like trade, on the military, on foreign policy, on all sorts of things of that kind. But I think getting into the weeds and talking about, you know, the details of Russiagate, I mean, that might be a bit, that might be difficult to get across in a debate like this, especially given, and I'm going to say this very straightforwardly, given that Barr and Durham and the Republicans in the Senate have failed him. If we now had a report about Russiagate, it'd be a different story. We do have a report about Hunter Biden.
Should he go after Hunter Biden in the debates? Because that could be a little tricky. And there's some people in the live stream saying it too, and I agree. If he mentions Hunter Biden, I think there's a very good possibility that Joe Biden will malfunction. I think someone wrote malfunction actually word for word. He has done it before in the past. Joe Biden has, you know, blown a gasket when they bring up the name Hunter Biden. There is that possibility that Joe Biden will malfunction. But there's also a PR risk maybe. And once again, people in the U.S. can chime in. They know better. Could this be a little bit of a PR risk for Trump by bringing up the vice president's son? Because, you know, the mainstream media will really go after Trump hard, saying, oh, you know, you shouldn't bring in family and all that stuff, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it could be a risk, maybe, even though they have a report.
It could be a risk. They do have a report. I think that makes all the difference. Again, I would go for it because the Hunter Biden is obviously the son. That's what in the end makes this thing toxic. Because Biden was the vice president and the Obama administration's point man in Ukraine. Hunter Biden was, of course, the director of this utterly corrupt company. I'll tell you the risk for me is I think if it were to be done well, it would be very effective. The problem is I'm sure the Democrats have rehearsed this with Biden exhaustively. I mean, this is one where they will have worked with Biden very hard to work out that he's got the right answers. And, you know, they'll have tested it out on, I presume you have focus groups in the US as we do in Britain, you know, with panels of people and to see what answers work and all of that. So I think that will, the Democrats will be ready for that. And of course, the other great problem is that they always bring up in this kind of situation, you know, Joe Biden's other son, the fact that, you know, that he had a tragedy in his life. Now, of course, the Democrats would not hesitate if there'd been anything wrong with Donald Trump's children to bring it up in a debate. And, you know, it seems to me that one possible line of attack would be for Donald Trump to say, look, you went after my son repeatedly, Donald Trump Jr., who is a patriot. There is no bad stories about him at all. He's written an actually very interesting book, which I haven't read, but my wife, by the way, has, interestingly, unusually. You tried to create some kind of narrative around him about the meeting with Veselnitskaya in Trump Tower, and it's now universally accepted that he did absolutely nothing wrong. Even your own report, your own senator's report, basically admitted that nothing outrageous happened. And yet, when it comes to your own son, you can't control him. He's able to go off on Air Force Two with the Secret Service protecting him, at the same time get himself involved with Ukrainian, corrupt Ukrainian companies, go to China, get himself involved with business people connected with the Chinese Communist Party and with the Chinese military, receive vast amounts of money from sinister Russian oligarchs like the Baturina, like Mrs. Baturina, and at the same time spending it, and this is factually established, giving large amounts of money to Ukrainian and Russian women, who then send them back to Russia and Ukraine in what somebody clearly thinks bears all the hallmarks of a human trafficking ring. I mean, these are facts. What do you say about that? If you're going to come after my son, as you have done, explain the conduct of yours.
Yeah, it has to be managed.
Very, very carefully. Given, as I said, that the Democrats will have rehearsed all of this exhaustively. They will have thought through all of these various angles. And I suspect they're probably rather good at that. Anyway, I would like him to do it. And I think that if it were done well, it would be fascinating. And it would be fascinating to get these answers, actually. And if we go back to Russiagate, I would love to know what happened at that meeting with Barack Obama on the 5th of January 2017. But again, I think a debate is probably not the right place for that. Yeah. I think that's more like a Senate or House committee, and perhaps a proper investigator coming and asking questions over many hours.
Yeah, that's up to Barr. I mean, the risk with Trump doing that at a debate is exactly what you said. You know, the Republicans have to sit there and kind of think to themselves,
yeah,
they've got so much ammunition on Biden. Do we really need to bring up, for example, his son? Because you already have so much to go after him with. Yeah. The other thing which makes Biden an interesting opponent is that you really don't have to do much. You just kind of have to sit back and watch him, you know, just say stupid stuff. And Biden is, if you just let Biden talk for 15 minutes, you know that something is going to come out of his mouth that is just going to be complete and utter nonsense. So maybe as, you know, Republican strategists, you just kind of tell Trump, look, hit him on the points, don't get too personal, and don't worry, in 2-3 hours, just being on stage with you for 2-3 hours, sooner or later, he is just going to, he's going to self-implode. You know, there's no risk. Don't take too much of a risk.
I agree. I think also the contrast between the two men, as I said, one dynamic, vital, exuberant, full of life, which Trump is. I mean, he's a man of tremendous energy and mental energy as well as physical energy. And you have this exhausted husk of a man on the other side. And I think the contrast, that contrast will come through. And perhaps you would smudge it by getting into very detailed discussions about forensic issues. Maybe, I mean, thinking about this, I mean, I'd be interested to see what our viewers think about this. Well, on balance, I think that, yeah, go on.
Sorry, one point that a viewer made is, you know, for example, if you do go after Biden, you can go after him with Ukraine, and you actually do have a video. So you could hit him on the video.
Yeah, absolutely, you could.
You know, statement that Biden made, which everyone knows, you have it on video. Biden said, you know, do this or else, you know, you're out.
Yes. I agree. I mean, as I said, I think with Hunter Biden and with Ukraine and with China and the Bidens, it's a lot easier than Russiagate, because Russiagate is still, I mean, it's so complicated. And I'm not convinced also, by the way, that the American people who are going to be switching into this program want to hear about that I don't mean that they're not interested in Russiagate. I think it's a misunderstanding. But I think what they're coming to these programs to see is who is the right person for president. They're not looking for a forensic discussion about who said and did what over Russiagate. So that's my instinct on this one. But, you know, I don't have that feel for you know, popular feeling in the US. The Democrats and the Republicans will be doing all the number crunching. I presume you do have what we call focus groups in the US, as we do in Britain. That's groups of people who are brought together in panels, and you bounce ideas off them and you see how they react. I mean, I'm sure that in the US you have it probably much more in a much more sophisticated way than we do. And I would have thought that by now both parties and both campaigns will have got a clear idea of how to approach these two very difficult questions.
Yeah, and I'm reading a comment here from Troels, and I agree. If you had a good moderator, and this is what the comment said, you can ask something like of Biden, did Comey and Yates lie? You know, tell us about the Logan Act. What was going on in the Oval Office? I think if you had an impartial, good moderator, who you know Chris Wallace is going to give really tough questions to Trump, that you already know. If he really wanted to be fair, he's got a ton of questions that he could ask Biden and not even involve Trump. I mean, that he really should ask of Biden. For example, what happened at the Oval Office? Were you the one that came up with the Logan Act? That's a very straightforward question.
Yes. Well, that's right. I mean, that's a very good point, actually, about the moderator as well, because the moderator will undoubtedly, I mean, will, I'm sure, be primed to side with Biden on many of these issues. And that's a risk. That's a danger. I would point out, though, that a very biased moderator, one very sympathetic to Biden, is probably going to be counterproductive again, given the structure, the perception, the correct perception across the United States that the media is already structurally massively biased against Donald Trump. So if the moderator is openly favors Biden, as at least one of the moderators, if my memory is right, openly favored Clinton in the 2016 debates, it could backfire horribly. And I think that's a thing to bear in mind. Chris Wallace, what I know of him, and of course, I mean, he's an American, he's an American commentator personality. So I don't know him as well as some people, as people in the US do. But he comes across to me as a rather clever and experienced individual. So that would make me very wary of trying to make assumptions as to exactly how he's going to run this. But I think he will be biased towards Biden. And I think he will be biased towards Biden in a clever way. And that would make me a bit nervous, or rather not nervous, but I mean, a bit careful about bringing up some questions where he would know he'd have the skill to be able to shift the balance of the argument in Biden's favor. So just bearing all of that in mind. Again, I hope and presume that the two campaigns and Trump's campaign is doing its homework properly and is working out how to respond to all of that and do it well.
Yeah, it's a dangerous thing because, and we'll do super chats now, but it's a dangerous thing because you know, you have Chris Wallace who openly hates Trump, but it's going to be Fox News. So the argument that the corporate mainstream media is going to say is, you know, well, why would he be biased? It's Fox News. You know, come on, you know, President Trump, this is on Fox News. So there's no reason for you to be upset, even though everyone knows that Chris Wallace does not like Trump at all. I mean, I'm not all for, you know, Fox News, Chris Wallace debates. Oh, no. I would much prefer Joe Rogan. I think he would be the most impartial.
Well, no question about this. Yeah. I mean, again, there's been a negotiation between the networks, and you know, they got Wallace. And as I said, Wallace, as it comes across to me, is a clever man, and he's going to be biased in favor of Biden in a clever way.
In a clever way.
And that's the thing that you need to be careful about. I mean, that's my impression. I mean, you know, people in the US might have a different view of this. I mean,
it would be different if you had Chris Cuomo as moderator, because then you could say he'd be clever, but in an absolute dumb way. So, I mean, it would be, you know, but yeah, Wallace will be a tough one. Anyway, let's see some super chats. What do you say?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it. Right. Let's go.
From Toilet Sauce, a €5 super chat. Trump could pick a Native American shemale, and they would smear whatever the woke crowd's gender pronoun for that person is.
True. Well, true. I mean, yeah. I mean, they will. I mean, they will. They're already going bananas about this. I mean, it, once upon a time, Supreme Court nominations were not, you know, this vast drama around them that we have nowadays. But you know, that's the way the United States has become. It's become worse, by the way, with every new nomination. It gets ever more, you know, volatile and angry. But there we are. That's Toilet Sauce is absolutely right. He's put it in his usual, dare I say it, pungent language, but he's absolutely right.
All right, thank you for that super chat. From Jim G, $5 super chat. Thanks for the awesome videos. Thank you, Jim G, for that super chat. From Damon, $5 super chat. This is one of the best podcasts. Thank you very much, Damon, for that super chat. From Charlie, $20 super chat. Started watching you guys early 2020. Have gone back and watched a ton of direct content. Great, amazing geopolitical work. I have learned so much from just watching. Thank you both. Cheers. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that. Much, very kind words.
From Raul, a $20 super chat. Thank you, Raul, very much for that super chat. From Edgar Durs, $4 super chat. Thank you, Edgar Durs, for that super chat. And that image with that super chat from Nigel, $4.99 GBP. Is it possible Democrats feel so enraged because they want Biden to nominate Hillary Clinton to Supreme Court? Is this a horrendous scenario? Is this horrendous scenario possible?
Absolutely.
It is a horrendous scenario.
It is a horrendous scenario, but I would absolutely not exclude it. In fact, if we get a Biden presidency, I'm not going to say it's likely. I'm not going to predict it's going to happen. But if it did happen, it would not surprise me at all. I mean, it'd be a disastrous idea. I mean, she's absolutely not fit to be on the Supreme Court in any conceivable way, not just because she's a politician, but because, I mean, you know, it's a very, very long time since she's been active in law in any real way. And the kind of law she did, in my opinion, isn't really the kind of law that lawyer or legal background that is suitable for a Supreme Court justice. I mean, I'm debating it as if it was a serious proposal. I mean, it should not be a serious proposal. It's a catastrophic idea. But given how the Democrats are nowadays, it would not surprise me at all.
All right, thank you for that super chat from Sparky. When Dad was 90 and beginning to get feeble, he occasionally had to use an EpiPen due to an allergy. When he used it, he was 15 years younger. The rest of the day, Biden could take an EpiPen shot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I've seen these things happen. I mean, obviously, some things are done for therapy. And I'm sure in this case, in the case we just heard, it was done for, you know, therapy. But in other cases, as I said, it's not done for therapy. And for Biden, it wouldn't be done for therapy. It would be done for a completely different and completely inappropriate purpose. And that would be bad for him. I mean, it would make him, it would accelerate his decline. I mean, I'm no great fan of Joe Biden's. I never have been. I've never thought much of him. But, you know, what they're doing to this, to Joe Biden is ethically wrong, actually.
I agree, but he's done some horrible things.
Oh, he's done some horrible.
Absolutely horrible things.
Horrible. Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, to use somebody, however terrible they are, to use them in this kind of way, I mean, you know, I would say the doctors and all the people who are involved, there ought to be ethical concerns about it. But, you know, we're far beyond any situation now where the Democrats, it seems to me, care about those things.
Yeah. From JJHW, £5 super chat. Thoughts on the police attack on peaceful protests in Trafalgar Square today? And Rishi Sunak's declaration of those deemed non-viable, declaration. Sunak Decollectation. I don't
know. Yeah, I mean,
I'm pronouncing that right. Yeah, okay.
These are two huge subjects. And by the way, I mean, I should say that I'm going to be doing my own channel. I'm going to be starting up that very soon. And I'm already, doing preparations on this. And I intend to focus more on Britain and British politics, which does not mean, by the way, that we will not be having discussions about Britain, Alex and I, on this channel also. But, that's one of the things I do intend to do, which is to focus more on the sort of granular events in Britain. Well, first of all, I've not fully up to speed on what happened in Trafalgar Square, but it does not surprise me at all. We are heading increasingly towards very, very aggressive policing in all kinds of ways. And contrast that, by the way, with what happened in Bristol when that statue was toppled, how the police weren't involved, even though, the law was broken. So I need to familiarise myself, however, more closely with the events in Trafalgar Square. I think what happened with Rishi Sunak, who is, just to explain to our American viewers, Chancellor of the Exchequer, this is the grand titles we have in Britain, it means our finance minister. He unveiled an economic package 2 days ago to support the British economy through the pandemic crisis. And I was underwhelmed by it. And I have various friends of mine who are business people, and they were underwhelmed by it too. They were saying, well, they weren't underwhelmed. They were absolutely, one of them was furious with it. And they feel that what's happening is that the government is no longer supporting them in any significant way. And this talk about, not supporting people who are viable, because this is, I think, where it comes from, viable businesses. Well, I was driving through London and I'm seeing shop after shop now with closed signs. I mean, it's now escalating right across the economy. So large sections of the economy are becoming gutted. And it's people who are at the, small businesses that are bearing the brunt of this. It's going to be an economic holocaust here. And I can see it happening. And it's remarkable, coming back to an earlier question, that the Conservatives are still doing as well in the opinion polls as they are. But lots to say about this. Perhaps a more in-depth discussion required. I look out for my channel when it comes, which will be very soon, within days, and I'll be discussing all of those things there. And definitely, as I said, Alex and I will continue to do programs together about the situation in Britain.
Yeah, the question for what you just said, Alexander, is once everything is gutted, who comes in and buys it all up?
Well, indeed. Well,
I mean, that's the, I've seen it in Greece and in Cyprus because we got gutted by the EU. And what happens is the people with cash and the people with money come in and they just buy it on the cheap. Absolutely. And I think that's exactly what's happening. Well,
absolutely. Absolutely so. Now, can I just say, though, it also changes lifestyles. I mean, in the area where I live, where I am very much alive. We had various, really, really nice restaurants, cafes, things like that. They're all closing. What will come after them? I mean, this is very difficult to, say what the new, it will change everything about our life balance. It will mean that, we can't go out in the evenings in the way that we used to do. Because what big companies, the people, as you said, with the deep pockets, are not going to have the same interest in opening up, local restaurants and family restaurants and family coffee shop cafes and things of that kind. So we're probably going to have big generic chains moving in, taking over.
Apps. You can order your food, Alexander, from the apps that they own.
Well, exactly. That's exactly what you're going to do. So it's all going to be completely different. It's going to be a much more centralized. Well, thank you, Alex. That's exactly what is going to happen. So it's going to be a completely different and ultimately less human world.
It's going to be centralized. Some may say it'll be globalized. Well, it'll be more central global, which is exactly what they want.
Yeah.
Anyway, I got one more super chat, but real quick. So Flying Boar is asking about Navalny update. We'll probably do a video on this just as a bookend to kind of, you know, close the book on this Navalny saga in Nord Stream. But it looks like, Alexander, if you want to do a very quick update.
Well, very quick one.
The final super chats here, and we'll wrap it up.
He's up and about. He's actually, by the way, and I thought this was quite interesting, he's actually thanked the Russian doctors and the Russian pilots who saved his life. And interestingly, he's not so far said anything very critical of the Russian, at all critical of the Russian authorities. He hasn't made any accusations against anybody, which is interesting.
Why is that? Why is that?
Well, I don't know.
Because they didn't go after him and he knows it. No, that's why he wants to go back to Russia. That's why he's not accusing them of anything.
Yes.
He's saying that because his only safe haven, this is just my opinion, his only safe haven is back in Russia because he knows he's expendable now to all these other guys. He's expendable to them.
Yes. And absolutely. And to the people who the people who tried to kill him. And I should say, I'm not going to name this person on this program for legal reasons, but I'm now starting to develop suspicions about one specific individual who I think has masterminded this affair. Suffice to say, he has interest in Britain, and he is a name that has been mentioned.
We know as well.
Exactly. So I'm dropping a few hints, but not enough. And I have to be careful what I say. This is the land where libel law rules very powerfully. But anyway, the other thing I would quickly say is that we'd be getting more comments out of Germany about Nord Stream 2 and about sanctions. We'll do a proper program about this, but it does look as if the prospect of those is receding.
Yeah. All right, let's see. Dekulakization, when the Soviets got rid of the kulaks with land.
It's exactly what you said, Alex, because, you know, if you think about what happened, you know, we had all these little peasant farms and peasants doing their things, and they were all, you know, Stalin came along and swept them all away, and what we got instead were these huge collective and state farms, which, by the way, are still the backbone. They've been renamed, but they're still the backbone of the Russian agricultural system. But that's what happened. You got one type of small-scale individual agriculture replaced by vast mechanized agro businesses. And yes, I think this describes exactly what we were talking about. Corner shops, cafes, restaurants, all going out. The apps and the people who control the apps coming in. So it's dekulakization. That describes it exactly.
Ed Flying Boar said the super chat update on Nord Stream 2 and Navalny. We answered that. We're also going to do a video on that, Flying Boar, as well. We'll do a final video to wrap it all up. And from William Jones, the final super chat, I received my mugs in record time and can report that the Texas Magic Mug is a magnificent platform for margaritas. Highly recommended to all. Yes, definitely. And we've got more states coming up. We've also got recommendations and requests for provinces in Canada, which I will get to as well. And if you guys have any countries that you would like me to put on the mugs, the t-shirts, the hoodies, the sweatshirts, the hats, all kinds of stuff, let me know, Alexander. I think we can sign off.
We can indeed. So there's Poland. And of course, this is my mug with the flag of the United States. And there's Switzerland, indeed. And if I can just reach over very quickly, you will see there is Britain. Okay, that's Britain. So I've got one with the flag of the United Kingdom of Great Britain.
Excellent.
So,
all right.
So they're all coming, and they're all amazing. And as I said, lots of flags of lots of countries, lots of states of the Union, lots of states of Canada are coming too. And I believe Australia's. Just tell us what you want, and we will accommodate you. We will work towards it.
And Sparky sent a super chat. Are they still tin mines on Cyprus? Just curious. No, there's not much of that stuff going on. Cyprus is an economy based on tourism and finance.
Didn't the Romans mine tin in some?
Yeah. Copper.
Yeah,
that's where you get the name. Update on Belarus from Flying Boar. An update on Belarus.
Well, he's been reinaugurated in a rather quiet ceremony. The protests are definitely winding down now. I mean, this is the European Union continues to dig itself into an ever deeper hole. They're refusing to recognize his legitimacy. But interestingly, they have not recognized Tikhanovskaya as a president in you know, as the legitimate president. They've not yet done the Guaido thing, so which I think most people now understand was a huge mistake. And of course, what is happening is that the people who are now looking increasingly like the winners, the big winners of Belarus, are the Russians. Lukashenko went and saw Putin in Sochi. All sorts of agreements were done. They were very, very quiet and secret about what those agreements were. But Lukashenko has revealed many of them in interviews in Belarus. And they strongly suggest that Belarus's economy is now going to be essentially fully integrated into Russia's. So the Russians have come out the big winners out of this affair. The European Union, in my opinion, has completely misplayed its hand.
Yeah. All right. Mariel, are you going live on Tuesday for the debate? I don't know if we'll go live. Maybe we'll do a live after the debate to break it down. Yeah. We're considering doing a live to talk about Hunter Biden and the FBI texts and all that stuff that's going on, because it's just really a lot of information.
Yeah.
And we've got a lot of videos on that, but maybe we'll do a live on maybe we'll do a live for that as well. But we'll keep you guys posted. And that's it. I think that's we are all done with super chats. I think we got most of the questions answered, all the questions answered. Mm-hmm. And we had a really good discussion. Thank you, everybody, for joining us on this Saturday live stream. And anything else you want to talk about, Alexander?
We're still going to be thinking of doing our Friday lives. We changed it this time because today's the day that it hasn't quite happened quite as we'd expected, but we felt that we should do it today because this is a big event with Amy. And please keep an eye out for my channel, which is now coming out very fast. And as I said, I certainly intend to look into British politics and all that's going on in Britain very, very closely, both the issues with the pandemic, the issues with the economy, the state of the parties, the problems that Boris Johnson is having, the various factions within the Conservative Party, and in my opinion, the desert of ideas, which is the Labour Party, which is, in my opinion, in a very, very bad state, actually.
And Brexit.
Brexit is the big overarching story. And of course, people in Scotland, You're not neglected either. I mean, I know a lot of people in Scotland. I have made no secret of the fact that I am somebody who very much believes and wants to see the United Kingdom remain united. But I have friends who are Scottish nationalists.
We'll announce Alexander's channel as well, guys, when we get it up. You can also go to my channel, which is already up. Thank you to everybody who subscribed and got that channel up to 5,000 subscribers in less than 2 weeks. Thank you, everybody. Please subscribe to that. Alexander's channel is coming up soon. Will you be able to cover Ireland as well in your...
Absolutely. I mean, I've got lots of friends in Ireland too. I know people in Ireland on both sides of the conflict. And of course, I don't want to give the impression that it will just be a channeled about British affairs. I'll be covering lots of other things, but I intend to take a more detailed look at Britain and other things going on all over the world too. I mean, I'm not going to artificially restrict myself on any one particular subject, but do keep an eye out. And as I said, if I'm the Oracle of London, as people always tell me, then I will deal a lot more with more London cases.
People don't know. I don't know. Well, maybe people know, but Alexander will sign off on this. Perhaps we'll sign off and I'll let you, I'm sure you want to get some dinner, Alexander. But Alexander is an expert in Russian as well as U.S. history, correct, Alexander?
Absolutely. This is I got my degree at the University of London in history. By the way, it was it was a first class degree, and a very, very high first. But I did both Russian and U.S. history. Now that was very unusual because most people did either one or the other. I very unusually insisted on doing both, and that's why I know quite a lot about both countries, and I developed a huge liking for both countries And this was, of course, in the 80s. It was when, you know, it was still the Cold War. And very different countries always. I mean, you know, these huge differences in culture and politics and history, but so fascinating. And at that time, I should add, American history was not a popular subject in British universities. I could never understand why, because I found it compulsively interesting. I thought it was one of the most interesting histories of any country in the modern world. And I learned so much from it. And I developed from that a huge love for the United States and for its culture. Also, I should add, I mean, you know, I became very interested in American music, American classical music, which isn't a subject that most people know a great deal about. And my wife, who's an academic and teaches English literature, is, of course, absolutely immersed in American literature, which is one of the great literatures of the world.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I love American history. It really pains me when I see what's going on in the U.S. that they try to erase that history. I think American history is really fascinating.
It's a lot of great
stories that have come out of the history of the U.S. In my opinion,
it is absolutely tremendous. I mean, it is a place with such a tremendous, huge arsenal of ideas in the United States, and good ideas too, and such a tremendous impulse on the part of so many people in the United States towards building democracy, to building something good, to building a good society. I am fully aware, I should also say, of, you know, the other sides of American history and American politics. I'm not sentimentalizing the United States, but I was vastly impressed by what I learned. And of course, I've always been very interested in economics. And it was hugely interesting to see how the US built its economy in the 19th century and the early 20th century, and the extraordinary contrast with the way the British were running their economy in contrast, and how, you know, the Americans were, you know, very dynamic and tremendously energetic and putting together these huge companies and coming up with these extraordinary new ideas and things of that kind. And it was such an extraordinary contrast with the sort of gentlemanly capitalism, which isn't really very gentlemanly, that we have here in Britain.
All right. So to wrap it up, Alexander, we'll be announcing your channel soon. Absolutely. People that are asking my channel, just my name, Alex Christoforou. Alexander's channel will be the exact same, Alexander Mercurius as well. So those two channels, those spin-off channels, are under our names. The one is currently running. The other one is going to be running within a matter of days. Please subscribe to those channels. Duran Shop, Corey Marie, thank you for that final super chat. Thank you both so much for USA Information. $20 super chat. Thank you very much, Cora, for that. And we are signing off, Alexander. Have a great Saturday, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us this Saturday. We really appreciate it. Thank you for your comments in the live stream. Thank you for your super chats. Thank you for hitting that like, for subscribing, for everything. Thank you very, very much, everybody.